And today's daf from Mitzray Shabbos Kodesh, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Tzadi Tet, and we're holding at the bottom of daf Tzadi Chet Amud Beit, and we had just gotten up to the Tana Rabbanan on the bottom line of Amud Beit. Tana Rabbanan, Charutzin hayu kirashim v'chalulin hayu ha'adanim. So basically the kirashim had to fit into the adanim in such a way that the adanim would not extend outside, obviously, of the keresh, because that would make a space between one keresh and the other, which means that we had to actually dig out the wood in such a way at the bottom of the keresh, the ama at the bottom of the keresh, so that it would fit in exactly into the two sockets that were in each one of the aden, and then the outside of the aden would come up straight against the same level of the wood that was the ama above it, all the way up to the top nine amas. It was all from the outside completely smooth. The only difference that you would see is that the bottom one ama looked like it was silver, which it was, except that it had actually two pegs from the krashim stuck into it. So that way, nir'in and the krasim that were the little clips, or the cufflinks, right? So the little links, there we go. The little links that were in between the lulaot that were made at the end. Remember, we had five and five at the, from the inside of the Mishkan, you would look up and you would see the place where the two sets of the yiriot were to connect it together. They were connected with these little loops of tchelet. And then inside of the loops, you put one loop over the other, and you put in a golden cufflink to hold them together. So that looked very beautiful from the inside of the Mishkan. That was a, looked like stars surrounded by a blue sky. So kikochavim barakia. Tana rabbana. Yiriot ha-tachtonot shal tchelet, v'shal argaman, v'shal talat shani, v'shal shesh. So as we know, the 10 yiriot that were directly visible from inside, they were made out of all of the various colors of wool, tcheles, argamana, tolat, shani, and they also had the linen that was mixed in the threads. The ones above them, the 11, 6 and 5, they were made out of maase izim, and they were made in a very, very special way, because gedola chokhma, we actually spoke about this earlier in the Masechet when we were talking about what the dinim would be of unusual types of tfiyah. So the special chokhmah that's mentioned in the Elyonot is greater than the chokhmah of those who worked on the Tachtonot. Note the difference in the psukim, that in the ones that were working on the regular Tachtonot, which were also quite complex, mixing all of these threads together, it says, v'chol isha chokhmat lev biyadeh tavu. So that over there we look at wisdom in the heart. But when it comes to the Elyonot, it says, V'chol anashim asher nasa liban otanu bechokhmah. And as the Ramban points out, nasa liban is a special madrega in which a person attempts to do something that appears to be completely out of reach and just jumps in to be able to achieve that which looked like it was impossible, and because of that, they're capable of doing it. Now, that means that the second layer of the 11 yiriot made out of izim was, for some reason, I mean, it seems like that ought to be a lot simpler than making the complex yiriot that were directly of the Mishkan. This was as the oihel on the Mishkan. Why is that? Because v'tanim bishum Rabbi Nechemiah, as we had earlier, shatuf bi'izim v'tavui min ha'izim, that there was a very special way in which the threads were made from the izim. And that was that the wool, well, it wasn't really wool, it's hair on izim, was washed while it was still on the izim and was actually spun while it was still on the izim. Now, there's two issues that are involved here. One, as the Sforno suggests, is that izim, the hair tends to deteriorate very quickly. As soon as it's taken off the izim, it loses its lanolin and any connection to the shine that it had because it's very coarse. But the other explanation is that when we're talking about things that were made out of the izim, remember, the closer the presence of the animal is to the asiya, and the less distance there is, very much similar to the idea of organic today, in which you feel more connected to things as they are processed with greater and greater closeness to the original product. The same thing was true over here in order to be able to be mischaber specifically to the izim. And this was, there was obviously a reason why we would use that kind of coarse material here. And that too was a reason to be, do it on the izim still. Let's get back to the Mishnah. So remember that the Mishnah analyzed the way in which we pass the kreshim from one wagon to the other. And as we're going to see, that defined for us, we already talked about the way it defines for us, a Rishus HaRabim Mikorah, if anything is covered, whether that loses the Din of Rishus HaRabim, and what areas of the wagon was considered to be Rishus HaRabim, how each one of the wagons was Rishus HaYochid, and therefore we learn out the halacha of the idea of passing over someone who is Moshit from one to the other, as opposed to someone who would be Zorek. But we're also going to see that we learn out the actual size of the Rishus HaRabim from these wagons. Because what we understand is that the area of the Rishus HaRabim, and this is a remarkable thing as well, we pointed out yesterday that our focus on the Mishkan here, of course, touches the very roots of the interrelationship of the Mishkan and Shabbat, and more deeply, our focus in two whole mesechtot on the issue of Hotzah, as opposed to the other 38 melachas, is because the essence of the Mishkan is that it moved and traveled, as opposed to the making of the Mishkan. And therefore, in a sense, Hotzah is the most primal of anything that would be learned out of the Mishkan. And obviously, that has to do with Maaseh Bereishis in terms of the nature of space and coordinates, which was the first step in setting aside a space in which it would be possible to evacuate a place for the Bria. And so what we're going to learn out is that even the way in which we understand the nature of Rishus HaRabim is built around what would it take to have a public thoroughfare that would allow us to carry the Kreshim in the Mishkan while there were still encampments. Because remember that we packed up the Mishkan very early on. First, we had Yehuda. We just read about this in the Parsha. First, we had Yehuda that started to travel. Gavi, are you stuck there? Or can you hear us? Because your video is just... Oh, there we go. Okay. So it would enable us to travel that way in a place that would be on the in the middle of all of the tents that were in the Machaneh. Because after Yehuda left, we still had Reuven to the side, and that means that we were going to be traveling along a path. How wide a path did we need in order to be able to carry these kreshim? Because that's going to define for us the Rishus HaRabim. So ultimately, we're going to go through once again an analysis of the size of the agalot, and using the size of the agalot, we understand how wide the street would have to be for two agalot to be able to travel side by side. In order to establish that, again, we need to take a look at the size of the kreshim and the way that they were piled, because then things will add up very clearly. We can understand what is absolutely necessary. Because, look, here's the information that's given. We know precisely how many kreshim there were in the Mishkan, right? Because we've got 20 on the north and 20 on the south, 6 in the back, an additional 2, one on each side, where the back meets the sides. So that gives us a total of 48. We also know from the Torah that 4 of these trucks were given over to B'nai Merari. So that means that we would be utilizing 4 trucks for transporting 48 of these kreshim. Now, that meant that we would have, that we would be stacking up a dozen kreshim on each one of these wagons. Now, we tried to analyze the way in which we would stack them up, and it came out that it was not realistic to stack them up the way we would like to, which would be to have them on the width, which was an amma and a half, because that would lead to all the problems of what do we do with the taba'ot, which were necessary for insertion of the poles that would keep them in place. So it turned out that we stacked them up on their thinner side, which is the thickness, which is one amma. The way that we came out in trying to figure out the place that Rav was saying was Rishus HaRabim in the middle of all of this was that we would take them, we would put them back to back, and that way, we on the thin side, we would pick 2 by 2, And that way we'd have two at the edge of the wagon, two at the other edge of the wagon, and in between was the area in which the various holders, again, I don't want to say rings because it depends on the shita, but either rings or actual tubes that you inserted the poles into. And that way they would be facing each other. And back to back, we would have the kroshim. So they would have some of the rings facing outwards and some of them facing inwards towards the other one since they were back to back. And that would be the most effective way to carry them. Now, once again, in order to analyze the width of the Rosh HaRabim, we need to go over how exactly the wagons were made. So let's start again. So again, we open it up with the Mishnah, but that Mishnah is just the quote over here, as usual. It's very misleading, because all we want to do right now is get back into the size of the wagon. So Omer Rav Mishum Rabbi Chiya, the Agalot, Tachtehem, Ubeinehem, Vitzideihem, Rishut HaRabim, we already went through that and figured out that we managed to get an Amah in the middle if we stacked them on their thin sides. And that way we could get 12 because we would have four stacks of three and they were back to back. So between the two stacks, since we're placing them on their thin side, which is one Amah, so we have one Amah and back to back with another one Amah on the front of the wagon, one Amah back to back with another Amah on the back of the wagon, which leaves us, if the wagon was five Amahs long, one Amah in between. And there's no din of lavud on one Amah. And therefore, that area was uncovered. And that was the place where Rav was saying that we've got a Rishus HaRabim, as long as it was not Mikorah. Otherwise, Rav would have a problem because Rav himself is the one who says that a Rishus HaRabim Mikorah is not a din of Rishus HaRabim. Omer Abaye, to understand how this thing worked, is Bein Agala La Agala Kimlo Erech Orech Agala. The distance between the edge of one of these agalot and the edge of the one that was next to it was the same distance as the length of the agala, not as the width, as the length of the agala. And how long was an agala? As we can figure out ourselves in a moment, it's got to be five amot long. So what this means is that since we describe the actual bed of the wagon as being 2.5 amot, and we had an additional 1.25 amah on each side for the axles and the wheels, which gave us a total of 5 per wagon, if we include the sides. The next wagon next to it was an additional 5. And now we're saying that between the ends of the wheels of one and the wheels of the other, there was also 5 amot. Now, if we're going to imagine it, we've got these kroshim, which were 10 amot long, and we're putting them on a wagon that's only 2.5. And then we've got another 1.25 that is on one side for the wheel and axle, and then another 1.25 on the other side for a wheel and axle. So then that's still only going to take up the 5 of the keresh. Now it means that we're going to have another 5 sticking out. If we have another 5 sticking out and we split it up in both directions, so we've got 2.5 sticking out of one side of the wagon, another 2.5 sticking out from the other side of the wagon, and then in the next wagon that was side by side, we would have the same thing. So obviously, we need 5 amot between the wagons in order to handle the 2.5 amot sticking out on both sides, right? Now, I dare you to drive down a highway like that. You could just imagine, boom, boom, boom. I mean, these kroshim are going to be smacking into each other, and it's a disaster, which is why Tosva says this is a crazy pshat. It couldn't be the right pshat, okay? And Tosva has other very cogent objections to this pshat. The other cogent objection is simply this. If it's true that we had the kroshim going side by side, that means that we had 20 amot of kroshim going along the Rosh Hashanah Rabin, which we are going to prove is only 16 amot wide. And that means that anybody on the side of the road gets his head knocked off if he's any higher than 10 tefachim as these wagons drive by. Now, that would have a lot of rolling heads and a lot of tents that would be cut off at the 10 tefachim height. And Tosfos says, that's crazy. It doesn't make any sense at all. So therefore, Tosfos suggests a completely different shot to what Rashi is saying. Tosfos understands that the two wagons, because Tosfos also, how do you know there were two wagons side by side? Maybe there were one wagon in front of the other, and there was only four wagons. I mean, where's this all come from? Like, you're telling us this is the way it is. Why is it this way? Therefore, says Tosfos, no, this is completely wrong. The only way it works is if we could actually stack the krashim on the wagons themselves, not have them sticking out of the back. That's crazy. And therefore, what really we're talking about is that the four wagons that we're saying were donated, those wagons needed to be hooked together in a frame that would allow the krashim to actually be placed over a double wagon bed. And that way we would have the entire carriage that was covered from one end of one wagon to the other end of another wagon. And what we did was is we connected the wagons with a long frame, and then we framed both wagon beds together. And we had, not as Rashi says, 1 1/4 on this side and 1 1/4 on the other side, giving us 2.5 in total of axles and wheels. No, this was turned into a real 18-wheeler kind of thing. In other words, what we did was we put in giant wheels on the side of the wagons that were surrounded by this frame. They were, in fact, 2.5 amas, because they were very, very big wheels that were going to be carrying this enormous load, which Tosis points out, the way Rashi's got it, I mean, it's just so unbalanced. How in the world are you going to carry a load like that on a 1 1/4 amma axle and wheel and so on? He doesn't like the whole shot. Therefore, according to Tosis, it's beautiful. The wagons were not separately stacked. They went two by two because you needed two in order to fit the 10 amma long krashim on the dual bed. That was the point. And because of that, since the beds were actually only 2.5, you had 5 amot between the beds that were connected by this outside frame. And that is what we're talking about. So we had a total of 10 in which we're going to be able to actually carry the krashim, is what it's talking about. And that makes a great deal of sense. So that if you add the wheel on one side, according to us, on one side, which is 2.5, and the wheel, the giant wheel on the other side, which is 2.5, then you end up with a total of 15 amot. And that, the Gemara is going to ask, if it's 15, where did we get 16 from? Fine, we'll worry about that. But the whole thing fits very, very beautifully with Tosfos' pshat, and then we don't have the wagons, banging against each other in the middle and wrecking the krashim, and we don't have the problem. Oh, did I forget to press record? No record. And we don't have the problem either of how do we know that there were two side by side, because there's no choice. Obviously, there were two side by side. So that means on each dual wagon, we were carrying 24 krashim, and that was quite a load. Okie dokie. So now let's just see that inside. Now, asks the Gemara, why exactly do we need 5 amot long? You say that the length of the wagon, and you just mentioned that sort of, you threw it in there as a throwaway line, we're supposed to just take it, that the distance between the wagons was the same as the length of the wagon, which means the length of the wagon was 5 amot. Where do we get that from? Why would we need 5 amot if we managed to stack everything up in 4 amot, right? And even if you want to say that, well, we need extra space for the rings that were sticking out, fine, add another half an amma for the area between. So why wouldn't 4.5, has the Gemara, be sufficient? But Arba v'Palga Sagi, it would be perfectly fine to have 4.5. No, that's because Kiyeche delo litchaku krashim. We don't want the krashim to be in a situation where they might be put under pressure, and in order to make sure that that wouldn't happen, then we made it longer. Now, Rashi understands this to mean that in the event that you would choose, And here, I think, is the issue, because, again, the other Rishonim take issue with Rashi on this. And I think that Rashi is viewing the whole sugya as there's a lot of work that goes into setting down these krashim. So, I mean, they weigh a ton. You've got these levim carrying them. It's very likely that before we're able to twist the keresh over on its side, it would be much easier for us to take the keresh and lie it down along the way that the wagon is misudar. So if we're going to now come, we want to have these krashim, we'd like, even though we know we're going to have to flip it on its thin side, we'd like to first just set it down. So if we set it down before we're able to make the next level where we have to flip everything on its side, then we're going to get into a problem, because if we lay them down on the 1.5 side, then we're going to have 4.5 with our 3 piles that we're trying to fit in exactly into the wagon. That would be 4.5. That's going to cause scratching and bumping. And therefore, in order to avoid that, we want to have the extra space. I believe that's what Rashi is trying to say, and that's how he understands it. Okay, others want to learn that we're still talking about doing it on the normal way, but that we want to leave enough space so that when we're putting them down, they don't hit each other and they're not under any kind of pressure. In any event, in order to make sure that that doesn't happen, we give an extra chatzi ama, which is a normal kind of thing. And therefore, we're assuming, judging simply from the logistics of the situation, that the wagons were 5 long. Omar Rava, the tzidei ha'agala, kimlo rochav ha'agala. Now, on the sides of the wagon, you had the same measurements as you had of the width of the wagon. And what was the width of the wagon? Shtei amot v'mechza. It was 2.5 amot. And why would we need 2.5 amot? What would be wrong if I only had amta upalga? If I had an amta upalga and I wanted to, I could just put them down on the thin side. And would there be a problem of sticking them in? In other words, we're worried over here again. That suppose we just need to set down the keresh. It's very heavy. We want to set it down on the actual length of the wagon. Can't we set it down in a ama v'chetzi, and then we could put it on the 1 ama side, and nothing would get hurt within an ama v'chetzi? So wouldn't that be okay even for our initial manipulation? Again, this is how Rashi is learning. Tosis disagrees with all of this, as we'll see. And therefore, we ought to be able to get away, even for convenience sake, in the rare case where the Levi's going to have to let something down in that fashion. Answers the Gemara, yes, that would be enough. But, ki echad lo lididu ha-krashim. We, after all, these krashim are very long, and therefore, we wouldn't want them to start wobbling from one side to the other. Again, as Tosfos says, this is crazy. I mean, it's really crazy. Think about it. You're talking about a 10 amma long, 500-pound thing, and you're asking why I need 2.5 ammas to support it? I mean, it's a chiddush for you that it's you don't want it to be shaking? Couldn't we get away with an amma and a half? Who would be crazy enough to try to get away with an amma and a half? Why would you get away with an amma and a half? So again, according to Tosfos, since we're talking about putting the wagons together, the whole issue over here is a different issue. We're not talking about a single wagon. We're talking about one of the wagon beds of a broadly expanded wagon. That's what we're talking about. Therefore, everything starts to make sense. You could fit things in, but they'll be a little bit squeezed. And you don't want them to be exactly fitting on. You want them to be able to have space that is easy for the levium to load up. Okay. Furthermore, when Rava says that the side of the agala, which is the axle and the wheel, is the same as the thickness of the agala, Rashi has to learn that that means the total of the two sides of the agala are the same as the thickness of the agala. Now, that's not what it says. So according to Rashi, we're taking the 2.5 and we're turning it into 2 sides of 1.25. But, I mean, that's a funny thing for the Gemara to say. So, according to Tosfos, again, it's exactly true. each side, because each bed had only one side, is 2.5. Really 2.5. And the wheels were much thicker. Okay, so in any event, this all works out. And we don't want them to be moving in any way. Wait a minute, says the Gemara, but then how do we get the idea that Rosh Hasharabim is 16 amot? I mean, don't we learn everything out of the Mishkan? Anan de gamrina lemi Mishkan. We're learning it out of the Mishkan, but now we just added up the Mishkan, and all we need is 15, not 16. Answers the Gemara, the 16th Amma was there in order to allow for someone to get to the side of the Agalah as it was moving in order to fix things if anything started to shake out of its place. So since we had these two thin back-to-back piles on the Agalot, in the event that there was a bumpy road or whatever, there was a Levi that would walk along the side. And as Tosis points out, obviously one Amma does not allow a Levi to go on both sides. There's only enough room in one Amma to go on one side. Fine. So if we noted that there was a problem, the driver would move a little bit to that side to allow the Levi to get across. Furthermore, as Tosis points out, how the heck is the way I'm learning, how the heck is the Levi going to get to do anything? It's 2.5 amos, just the wheel. How's he going to get across the wheel in order to do anything for the setting up the krashim? So Tosis says, what's the problem? He carried a particular type of instrument or pole that he was able to grab the carriage and to make sure that it wouldn't fall over. So since, again, remember that we're talking about Occam's razor over here, the way Tosis is learning, that's the whole point. What is the absolute minimum that we can get away with in order to be able to understand what the size is of a Rosh Hasharabim? And that is the only right that we have to derive from the Mishkan. So with the information that's given to us, the most that we could do is say, we know that we needed 16 amot on the Rosh Hasharabim. And that's absolutely true, beautiful, and it gives us a makor in the Mishkan for how to actually define the Rosh Hasharabim. So everything works out beautifully. According to Rashi, again, this is very problematic. The Rosh Hasharabim itself, remember, does not extend over 10. So basically, the fact that the krashim were above 10 tvachim, they don't go into the size of Rosh Hasharabim, and because they're going over the sides. What Rashi does about the fact that people's heads are falling off as it drives, or the tents are being cut down, whatever, okay, that I can't tell you. But that's not Mechayev, the distance of the Rosh Hasharabim. The only thing that's Mechayev, the distance of the Rosh Hasharabim, is the actual size of the wagons. Okay, so the wagons, we know, needed to have 5 amos between them, because otherwise there would be no way for the krashim to be balanced in the middle. Obviously, Rashi's going to have to learn that they were somewhat unbalanced because they must have stuck out a little bit more to the outside where they would be bumping into each other all the time. He doesn't bother talking about that, but that's a given. And therefore, according to him as well, 1.25 for axle and wheel, 2.5 for body, 1.25 for next axle and wheel, 5 amot between the two wagons, 1.25, 2.5, 1.25 equals 15. That's all. From both sides, there must have been an extension, but that's above Asaret Tvachim. And extensions are not part of the Rosh Hasharabim. That's how Rashi's learning it. Okay, everything now is very clear, and except, of course, in Rashi's pshat again, this poor Levi has got to, like, duck under things in order to take care of things. But okay, that's no different than everybody else's head that's coming off. So the Levi's just got to be really careful there. All right, we're ready for Sir Richard, who is about to give us a glorious rendition of... Truly glorious. Chuliyat Habor. Now, this is a very strange Mishnah. The Mishnah wants to talk about a rock which is 10 tefachim high and 4 by 4 tefachim wide, that's Rishus HaRabim. That's lovely. Yeah, I mean, okay, we talked about this all through the Masechet, but here's the Mishnah that's coming to define the midot of the Rishus HaRabim, of the Rishus HaYochid. Now that we spoke about what Rishus HaRabim is, this is what Rishus HaYochid is. Well, what's this jazz about the bar? I mean, obviously, if we're talking about concave and convex surfaces over here, the bar is meant to be telling us taking something out of the bar into Rishus HaRabim, right? And it's trying to tell us that the bar is a Rishus HaYochid. So why are we talking about the Chulyat HaBor? The Chulyat HaBor means the little area where you've got bricks around the well, you know, to prevent the kids from falling in. Every well's got that little brick thing around it, you know, and then on top you've got the handle and so on. I mean, why is the point the Chulyah? We should just have said, if a bar is 10 tefachim deep and 4 by 4 wide, it's a Rishus HaYochid. Loma Lila Misnei asked the Gemara exactly that question. What does this mean? Why are we talking about the little area of wall around the bor? And then we mention a sela, which is obviously meant to be high. We should say habor vasela. That if you have a hole that's 10 deep or a sela that's 10 high, and they're 4 by 4, if you take out from that hole or from that sela, in either case, you would be chayev because both of them are Rishus HaYochids, and whether they're concave or convex, and you bring them out to Rishus HaRabim. That's all you got to say. Ah, this is coming to tell us a big chiddush. It's actually a raya to Rabbi Yochanan, because as Rabbi Yochanan pointed out, bor v'chulyato mitztarfim la'asara, that actually, despite the fact that we're creating the Rishut HaYochid from two completely different elements. One element, let's say, is a 5 tefachim deep hole. A 5 tefachim deep hole is not a Rishus HaYochid. The other element is a 5 tefachim high wall on top of the hole. A 5 tefachim wall is not a Rishus HaYochid either. But if we put the 5 tefachim high wall at the edge of a 5 tefachim deep hole, then internally, we do have exactly the 10 tefachim that we're looking for. And Rabbi Yochanan says that's what's important. So that the inside area is defined as 10 tefachim between the hole and the chulia. And that's why the Mishnah separates it in this fashion, so we should understand the implication. Okay. What happened to Naftali? Sheesh. This is Merumez, by the way, in an old song where the bor actually sings. I'm sure you've heard that song. Me and Julia down by the schoolyard. So that means between the bor and the Julia, you actually can have 10 tefachim. Okay. So, Tanya Nami Hachi, there's actually a brisa that says this beferish. Bor bereshut harabim. So let's say you have a bor. That is Amuka Asara V'Rechava Arba. So it's 10 tefachim deep, 4 tefachim wide. Ein Mimal Inhei Mena B'Shabbat. You can't carry out the water from the bor, because if you try to carry the water out of the bor, you're going to be carrying from the Rishus HaYochid, which is the bor, into Rishus HaRabim, in which you are standing. Unless what you could do is you could put a mechitza all around it, and if that mechitza was 10 tefachim high, then you would be carrying into a Rishus HaYochid. So you're carrying from one Rishus HaYochid into the adjacent Rishus HaYochid. Both of them are yours. There's no problem with that. The question, of course, that's obvious over here is that we've already mentioned that there's a special thing which is called Pasei Be'erot. I'm going to get in more into that later. Pasei Be'erot are a completely different type of mechitza, which is made out of corners. 4 corners. You're all familiar with the different types of optical illusions that are created by putting simply the corners of something, and your eye completes a square very often if it's done correctly. And that's exactly what Pasei Be'erot are. We supply you with corners. And then those corners are matir, the area inside, as if it's Rosh HaYochid. Tosis is bothered by, why does it say you have to make a full mechitzah of Asarat Tvachim, and why can we not have Paseh Beiraot? And he says a very important yesod, which we're going to be learning about in Erevin. Paseh Beiraot are a special din that was made specifically for the Rabbim, not for a Yochid, to enable people that are in caravans to be able to take out water on Shabbat. And furthermore, they are not cisterns. They are wells. Here we're talking about a bore. So a bore is a cistern, and therefore for a cistern, it doesn't work. And all of this we'll be seeing in Erevin. I just didn't want to make everybody get into the habit of thinking about a bore requiring a full mechitzah around it of Asarat Tvachim. Furthermore, you couldn't even put your hand in, take a cup of water, and drink it over the edge of the bore. You couldn't do that either because the Rabbanan asserted that because it's so likely that you're going to pull back and you'll take the cup with you. So the only thing you could do is you could bend over with your head and most of your body, then you would be allowed to do that. And concludes the Braita with exactly the issue we've been talking about, Bor v'chuliyata mitztarfim la'asara, that actually, just like Rabbi Yochanan said, if the bor itself was only five, then if it has a chulia of five, it would also be mitzarev. Boy mine Rav Mordechai mi Rava. So Rav Mordechai asks Rava something that seems very clearly to be part of the Mishnah, and therefore it's very strange. As it says, he says, imagine a case like this. You've got this column in Rosh HaSarabim, and it's exactly 10 tefachim high, and it's 4 tefachim wide. You throw something up, and it then falls down onto this amud. Would you be chayev or not? What's my problem? Well, look, we could say, mi amrinan, hare akira be'isur, v'hare hanacha be'isur. Bottom line is, I picked up this ball, let's say, that I threw there in the Rosh HaSarabim, and it has now landed right there in the basket where I wanted it to land, and I score. But problem is, in order for it to get into the basket, it had to go above 10 tefachim and then go into the basket. So then that means that it actually landed from a Mokum Ptur, not from the Rosh HaSarabim. Now, as Tosis points out, now hold on a minute. We said before that if you're walking in Rosh HaSarabim and you're carrying something lamala me'asora, you're still going to be chayev, right? And didn't we have the sugi before? If somebody walks out of a store and he goes through the Tzidei Rosh HaSarabim, which may be a mokum ptur, and then he walks out into Rosh HaSarabim, he's chayev. So why all of a sudden are we worried about something that is coming from a mokum ptur? We know that if something comes from a mokum ptur, it's okay if the akira and hanocha was done kehalocha for Chilul Shabbos, so to speak. Tosis explains a very important point. The point is that the only case that we're talking about, says Tosis, is where specifically the gravity is what attracted it and not you. If you could throw it directly onto this thing, then of course you would be chayev. We don't care where it came from, because that would be the same as you're carrying it. If it's coming directly from your koach, from Rosh HaYochid to Rosh HaRabim, vice versa, we don't care that it went through a makom ptur. We've seen that multiple times in the Gemara. But what we're talking about over here, in order to score on your basket, is you had to throw it up. Now, then, because of the vector, it ends up now being pulled down into the basket. And that was the whole chokhmah of it. But you didn't get into the basket. You just allowed it to be in a position where it would be gravitationally attracted to the basket. That's my question. Are you chayev when gravity takes something out of a mokum ptur and you didn't throw it to that place? So what's the din? Do we say that the akira is be'isr and the hanoch is be'isr? Or do we say, look, you basically put something into a mokum ptur and then allowed it to be attracted by gravity down into the Rosh HaYochid? That's not my responsibility. I didn't do it from Rosh HaYochid to Rosh HaSarabim and vice versa. Or Marley, well, that's a Mishnah, man. What kind of crazy question is that? Now, obviously, he was talking about our Mishnah. The Mishnah says if there's a big rock, well, isn't that the same case? There's a big rock. So, actually, he was not very happy, Rav Mordechai. Was not very, you could show your face, Mordechai, there, you know, for this particular happy occasion. So Rav Mordechai was not happy with this. I mean, it's your mother's yard site, so it's good that you're here in the sugya. And he said, oh, man, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So he goes to Rav Yosef, and he says, what would be the din? And Rav Yosef says, what do you mean, what would be the din? It's a Mishnah. Oh, God, he says. Another guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So he goes to ask Abaye. Abaye says, what's the question? It's a Mishnah. He says, tell me something. Did you guys all learn how to spit together? I mean, that's what you're doing over here. You're spitting. I mean, tell me something intelligent here. Kuchu barukada hadari tafita, what, you mix your spit in order to get it all in the same place? It's ridiculous. So they said to him, what do you mean? Isn't it the Mishnah? Va'atlo tizbra? No, tell me, I don't see what you're saying. It says if you take off of that rock or you put it on that rock, you would be chayev. So obviously, in order to get it on top of a ten tefachim rock, you were going to have to take it off of the rishus of the makom p'tur. And the Mishnah's not mechalik how you got it there. It doesn't say if you actually would specifically set it down. Doesn't matter. It's just one of the many, many cases. We could throw it there. We could have it coming down. We could go up from the bottom. It doesn't matter. It says that you would be chayiv. So Rav Mordechai said, look, the Mishnah might be talking about a needle. A needle. Big deal. A needle is three-dimensional, man. I mean, what do you think? How thin of a needle is it? We're in flatland? The needle's going to have to also go above 10 tefachim in order for it to get down to 10 tefachim. How are you changing anything by saying it's a needle? Machat nami, yev shalom medalya purta. The machat's got to get up there, and in order to get up there, it has to go through a mokum p'tur. I don't care how thin you want the needle to be. Ah, but if we're talking about something like that, then remember that the halacha also is, let me ask you something. Suppose there was a little crack in the rock. Uh-huh. So if something is in the crack in the rock, then it's not in the Rishus HaYochid? It most certainly is. So you put the needle in the crack, okay? And what about if there's a little bit of a lip on the rock that goes lower than 10 tefachim? You're telling me that the extended lip is not part of Rishus HaYochid? It certainly is. We've seen that a million times. Something that is up against the Rishus becomes the part of that rishus. So they're back in the first parak. So if we're talking about a needle, why would you have to say that it is something that went above 10 tefachim? Look, I understand that that's certainly the general mashmaut of the Mishnah. I was asking you to bring me a raya. I'm not so stupid that I didn't know it was a Mishnah. When you're giving me an answer, it's a Mishnah. Thank you very much. It's just insulting. So we could be talking about that either Islay Mursha, Inami Deramya Bacharitza, or you put it into a crack on the rock. You don't have a clear raya, okay? I'm smart enough to know the Mishnah too. Omer Misha, boy Rabbi Yochanan. I have another question. Suppose you have a wall, okay? The wall is there in Rosh Hasharabim, and it's 10 tefachim high, but it is not 4 tefachim wide on top of the wall. So then if you would put something up on the wall, that would not be taking something from the Rosh Hasharabim into Rosh Hashayachid, right? Okay. Now, suppose you finish building this wall, and it went all around the Carmelite, which in effect turned the Carmelite into Rosh Hashayachid, because now the Carmelite is surrounded by a 10 tefachim fence, which means that the Rishus Carmelite is now a definite Rishus HaYochid, Bidiraisa, you'll be chayev. What's the din at the top of the wall? You threw it, this thing, and it landed on top of the wall. What would be the din? Miyam rinat kiva de inarach of arba makam turhu. So do we say, well, in itself, the top of the wall is not 4 tefachim wide, so it's still a makam tur. Or do we say, since it creates the space within it to be Rishus HaYochid, we should look at that Rosh HaSayachid as if it's come up to the level of the wall, and the whole thing is basically one Rosh HaSayachid. Omar Ula, look, I don't care how you want to describe it. That, you know, that's all your imagination in terms of making it malya. There's a very simple idea here, and that is kal v'chomer. La'acherim oseh mechitza, la'atzmo lo kol sheken. If the outside of this wall serves as the mechitza for the entire area within the, what was originally a carmelite, then how would we ignore its impact of creating a Rosh HaSayachid on itself? It's good enough to make Rosh HaSayachid because of its very presence there. It's not good enough for it to be part of Rosh HaSayachid. It manam yom Reb Chiya bar Ashi yom Ravach yom Reb Yitzchak yom Reb Yochanan kotel b'rshut harabim gavua asara ve'ino rachav arba'a u'mukaf le'karmelit. It makes the Carmelite a Rosh HaSayachid. That then is precisely what we just said. Hazorek v'nachal gabav chayav. Why? Because if la'acherim oseh mechitza, if it could be a mechitza for the other space, which was initially a carmelite, la'atzmo lo kol sheken, certainly for itself, it should be a mechitza. Boy, Rabbi Yochanan, I got another question for you. You've got a bor which is only 9 tvachim deep. Now, you go ahead and you take out one tefach of a bottom layer that was at the bottom of the bor. You pull it out of the bor. Now, that means as you take it out, the bor is now 10 tefachim. But initially, it was part of the bor. So, did you take something out of Rosh HaSayachid? Or did it become Rosh HaSayachid only after you took it out? Oh, man. There's just no end, huh? So, what would be the din? If you were Akar Mimeno Chulia, and at the point where you took out that additional level, it became 10 deep. Mau, do we say that akirat chefetz vasiat mechitza b'hadik adadik atu mechayev? Is this looked at as one instantaneous reality in which there is a bar of asara from which I'm removing its bottom piece? Or do we say, but when you went to remove the piece, there wasn't a bar of asara? Olo mechayev. Ve'im tim tzolomer, and if you want to tell me that the din is the kivin delavim mechitza asor miikara, that since when you went to do your akira, you did not have a mechitza of 10, you would not be chayev. How about the other case? Suppose the bor was 10 tvachim deep, and you carry a chulia from Rishus Harabim, and you now lower that chulia into the bor, which now turns the bor into a makam tur. So, it never landed in the bor. Or did it land in the bor? Oh my gosh. I'm really confused. Do we say that hanachat chefetz v'siluk mechitza was all one event, and therefore you're chayev, or not? Wait a minute. Rabbi Yochanan asked that. Rabbi Yochanan himself already solved that problem. He did? Yeah, remember? The Mishnah has zorek arba amot bekotel lamala me'asarat vachim kizorek ba'avir lamata me'asara kizorek ba'aretz. Okay, and somebody who throws arba amot above 10 tvachim, but it's, as we're going to see, Rabbi Yochanan explains, we're talking about something which is sticky. It's a fig. So you were zorek ba'aretz arba amot. Take this case. You throw it along the ground, and it's now 4 amos above the Rosh HaRabim, which is normally chayev, but it sticks to the wall that it hits. So the total distance is 4 amot from where I threw it to where it hits, and now it's sticking to the side of the wall, and it says it's chayev. And if we asked, of course, what do you mean it's chayev? How could it be standing in the middle of the air? It was never nach. And Rabbi Yochanan explained. It's talking about a nice, big, sticky figgy, and it was a dvela shemena, and that's what we're talking about. Now, it still doesn't make sense, because when the fig hits the side of the wall, now there's no longer 4 amot that it was actually transferred. Because, I mean, this is like the bor v'chulia. You now made the distance less than 4, because the fig itself has lessened the distance. Oh, come on. That's not the same at all. What are you telling me? That the whole wall extended because you got a little sticky fig on it? That's ridiculous. Over there, you're not mevatel the fig to the wall so that now the wall is no longer where it was. It's now at the end of the fig. In the case of the bor, when you put in the chulia and the bor, you now have changed the depth of the bor. Over here, just because there's a fig at the end doesn't mean that now the distance is any different. That fig isn't going to stay there. And therefore, hatam lo mevatele, ocha mevatele. Boy, Rava, I got a similar kind of problem. Let's imagine a case where we got four pegs in the ground, right? Now, on top of these pegs, there's nothing. You go ahead and you take a block, a board, and it's 4x4, and you throw it on top of these pegs, okay? So now it is a Rishon Sayachid. It's 10 Tvachim. And it's 4x4. But, I mean, before there was nothing there at all. So now when the piece lands, then are on top of these thin pegs over here, what's the din? Am I now chayev or not? Because I made the Rishon Sayachid. I understand. What are you asking? That's what we're just talking about. This is the same thing. I mean, you're not changing anything from the thing that we just asked, where Rabbi Yochanan was talking about. You're asking whether that was Rabbi Yochanan's point. No, of course. Rava wasn't just repeating a previous point. Rava asked, what would be the din if I throw this board and there's a cup of coffee on the board? Now, the board lands, the cup of coffee lands with the board. Okay, so the question that I have is, do we say that since I threw these things together, so that's basically the issue, if you hold that it's kanachat chefetz vasiat mechitzat dami, or do we say that kiven delo efshe delo midle porta? Now, wait a minute, when the board lands, aha, the cup of coffee pops up, right? And then it lands. Oh, so now I've actually established momentarily before the landing of the cup of coffee. So for 1/10 of a second before, I should be able to distinguish the creation of the Rishon Sayachid with the landing of the cup of coffee. So now I should be chayev for taking the cup of coffee from the Rishon Sarabim to Rishon Sayachid. So basically, I mean, this is a serious issue for anybody who wants a nice post-davening little cup of coffee, right? What do you do? Okay, so that's my question. It got if popped up a little bit and then land. I mean, look, that was the whole kunst of throwing it with the cup of coffee. Not everybody can do this, you know? So then it would be similar to asiyat b'chitza and then having the hanachat chefetz dami. What's the din? Teku.